huge news, years in the making, my brand new book that my publishers refuse to publish, Money Matrix. Beat the money system and build generational wealth. Understand the three main ways that the banks productize you and make money from you. You'll be able to turn that system against itself, build generational wealth and multiple streams of recurring income. It's all at moneymatrix.cash. And if you're quick, the first few hundred registrants and buyers will receive many special bonuses from me. The brand new Moneymaker Summit 3-day special event. Meet me at a champagne reception. Meet me at a multi-millionaire networking dinner. Go now, moneymatrix.cash. This is huge.
Welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast.
What does the word disruptive mean to you?
It means going beyond the ordinary, going beyond the status quo.
Not thinking in the conventional way, not just sort of following the herd.
Disruptive means taking things up, you know?
Disruptive entrepreneur is somebody who sees the problem and embraces the problem with a new way.
Shake up and awakening.
Quality will take care of itself, and you'll go from being disruptive but also profitable.
When you use your own reservoir of talent, when you love what you do, then you disrupt.
Mix it up, change it up, and dominate.
And now, your host, 8 times best-selling author and double world record holder, Rob Moore.
Hi, it's Rob, and welcome to the Disruptive Entrepreneur Podcast. Now, in the history of the 200-odd episodes, this is only the second time I've invited a guest back for a second interview. I love him that much. Now, my guest that you're about to hear a conversation with myself and himself, Gerald Ratner, he was obviously very famous for a gaffe, and actually, so much so that there's a phrase now called doing a Ratner if you make a bit of a gaffe or a boo-boo. Now, I don't want to talk about that in this conversation. This is nothing to do with that. That doesn't define Gerald. He's such an experienced, interesting chap. Inflation adjusted, he was turning over nearly $8 billion a year in his businesses when he owned most of the jewellery businesses in the UK. And we talk about innovation. We talk about how business has changed, how Gerald has moved through difficult times, how to deal with critics, trolls, haters, how to make money in 4 different niches across 4 different decades. He's an Arsenal fan, so we talk a bit about the pain of being an Arsenal fan. If you want to know a lot more about his gaffe and how big and bad it was and how it defined him and how to go through that kind of difficulty, you should listen to the episode I did with him, which was way up in the first few episodes. But for a more conversational approach to the man who is Gerald Ratner, who's a great guy, listen right now. Gerald, thank you for doing the interview.
It's always a pleasure to see you, Rob.
Yeah, you too. Arsenal are 1-0 down, aren't
they? Yeah, well, you'd have to put me in a bad mood straight away. But I didn't come a great surprise.
No, they might be 2-1 up by the time we finish. So
I wouldn't put money on that, no. Man City are playing fantastic.
It's a bit scary.
Yeah, but you've got the same aggravation that I've got with Liverpool.
Yes, I have. Yeah. I like the way you spun that back on me.
Yeah, why not?
So what have you been up to? What are you doing with your time at the moment?
Well, I love speaking, as you know, listening to my own voice. It's been become very, very busy. I have, somebody said to me, he's actually the guy who bought my house, and he's made a lot of money in advising companies about their websites. He's working with companies like Halfords at the moment, because a lot of the retailers were a bit weak on their websites, and he's brilliant. And he said to me that he's always on LinkedIn, but he never sees me on LinkedIn at all, he says, and that is, as far as networking is concerned, and speaking particularly, he really feels that's very, very powerful, more powerful than anything else. So now I've now posted, every time I'm driving around, mad, which I did, I've always done with Facebook, but that is not really the right audience in a way. So I've now posted a lot of the speeches on LinkedIn.
And I don't know whether recordings of them.
No.
Or just where you're going.
Just a picture of me. Yeah. Somebody taking a picture of the, just say that I enjoyed sort of doing that for Barclays or went up to Toyota or something like that.
So you've got quite a diverse client base. Us, yes. Toyota.
Well,
Barclays.
It did start off when it started that it was always insolvency conferences and people who get into trouble like timeshare, because they used to lock people in rooms and not let them out. till they bought something. Which when I put that to them, they said, well, actually that works, believe it or not. You know, it's a bit like getting millions of emails the whole time. It does drive you mad. It's aggressive, but it works.
I remember reading your book in 2006, you know, as you know, I think your book's great and I've recommended it to a lot of people.
Yeah, thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
And you sold a load of memberships for your gym before you had the deal done to own the gym, is that right?
Yes, and you know, a lot of people, when they sign up a start of a new company, they get very scientific about it and they check the demographics is the first thing to do, and they do a lot of research, and then they would spend a lot of money. In the case of a health club, they would buy the premises and start hiring staff and hope that it's been successful. So I didn't really want to take that risk because I didn't have a lot of capital at the time, because I just, you know, was out of work after losing my job and everything. So what I simply did was to blag it and to give people the impression, although I didn't technically tell a lie, because I didn't say that I hadn't signed the building, but it was only in solicitor's hands. I hadn't acquired it yet officially. In fact, the reason I hadn't acquired it, because I couldn't get the capital. So on the basis of having it in solicitor's hands, I was offering the public in Henley an opportunity to sign up for membership, and on the basis of the fact that I got 750 people to sign up with their direct debits, it wasn't just a piece of paper that they'd signed up, their direct debits, then that gave me the ability to raise the cash. So I always believe, you know, avoid conventional wisdom, do things in the indirect way, and, you know, however clever you are, a lot of new businesses fail, and this was, there was a no lose situation with this, because if I hadn't signed up people on the back of an advert that I put in for the club, I would have just walked away and not signed it with the lawyer. So I always think that's, you know, you've got to be a bit cautious.
So it's kind of like ready, fire, aim, isn't it? It's like, you know, go and make some sales and get some money in the bank before you spend 2 years creating the perfect product.
It's a bit that the people have now referred it as like crowd share.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. I don't know whether it is that or not, but I always think that don't go in too heavy at the beginning. Don't risk everything, because there's always something that's going to be unforeseen. So if you can sort of do something without committing huge amount of funds, and then once you know that it's going to be successful, then you can go mad.
Yeah. So before the cameras went on, you said you've got about 30-odd speeches to do before the end of the year, and you're really busy with that.
Yeah.
So how much of your time is divided between Gerald Online and your jewellery business and your speaking business?
Well, the beauty of the Gerald Online business, and now it's trading under lots of different names and trading in India, the beauty of that is that I could basically run that business from a deck chair in Southend, you know, with an internet business.
It's living the dream in Southend.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, Southend's actually quite nice, but it's, you know, as I do travel a lot on the road, like today, and go and visiting various different places, you know, it is great that I can still be writing. So it's difficult to know how much I do. I'm always got my phone on my lap. Have you got your new iPhone X yet?
Not yet, no. No, because the way they launched it was you had to pre-order it.
Right.
And then they would tell you a specific date and time you had to go to your Apple shop.
Right.
And you have to go to your Apple shop and be there. Yes. I can't just, like in Peterborough, they don't have an Apple shop.
Apple
shop's a bit upmarket for Peterborough.
Well, I was wandering around Peterborough. It was very nice the other day.
Well,
yeah. Lovely cathedral. The cathedral is amazing.
Yes.
Anyway, sorry, I interrupted
no,
you.
No, that's all right. I mean, the KFC's a bit upmarket for Peterborough. So
Careful, don't criticise your own brand. I made that mistake.
Yeah. Touché, Gerald, touché.
Peterborough's very important to you.
It is, and you know what? It's been great for me, and I'm only joking. I can't just be at a beck and call of Apple and go to Cambridge at a specific time that they, because, you know, my diary might be booked out for weeks at a time.
You're slightly busier than me, but I just order it on Vodafone.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, my assistant, basically, who does all this kind of stuff for me, he said, you have to go to the Apple shop at this designated time if you want to get your iPhone.
If you want to buy it from Apple, which is cheaper to buy it, even though it's £1,000, it is cheaper than taking out a 2-year contract with a...
So you're saying you don't have to go to the shop, you can just buy it through your phone?
You can buy it through your phone, but you obviously you're going to have to pay £66 a month for 2 years, which then includes the SIM, which is more expensive.
Yeah.
I think it's, I was told it was slightly more
expensive. Did you get one?
I ordered one and I'm in the second lot.
They're clever with their launches, aren't they? Because, you know, I think it was open for like 15 minutes and then closed, but you're not telling me they sold 100 million. You know, I think they're good with their launches.
They're absolutely brilliant. Everything they do is absolutely brilliant. And you know, they're about the... I was one of the few people when I was running Ratner's to start this, which you see everywhere today, discounts, everything is on offer, and you know, when you're not on offer you don't do any business, and it's always, you know, 50% off this and that, 2-for-1, it's always promotional stuff. I actually didn't start it, I copied it from Dixon's, that were really the first pioneers of it, but it was very successful, and now everybody does it except for Apple. Which is interesting.
They do the opposite, don't they?
They do the opposite, and they're the most successful company of the lot.
Yeah.
You will never get a disc. Even I had to buy the case for the Apple
X. And then you have to get a battery pack, 100 quid.
Yeah, everything is ridiculous. The earphones are £176. That is madness.
Yeah.
And they're the only earphones that you can use for it.
Yeah, and then you'll lose them because they're that big.
Well, that's what I said. I said to the bloke in the Apple store, that's ridiculous. They're going to fall out because there's no wire.
Yeah.
And he shook it. He's obviously been trained. You know, it wasn't something that he did off the cuff. He's been told by, you know, exactly what to do. And he was shaking his head and demonstrating, and they didn't come out, you know.
Yeah. So I thought, and I don't know if I'm going to be proven to be right or if I was just way off the mark, but I thought after Steve Jobs passed away, I thought they'd start to tail off because I felt that he was a great innovator and I felt that he was able to get things out of people that they couldn't get out of themselves and I couldn't see how that was going to be replaced. And I really don't think they've innovated that much since Steve Jobs passed on, you know, just another version of the phone, another version of the iPad. You know, what new things have they brought out? When Steve Jobs was alive, you know, the iPhone was radical. Obviously, the way he designed the Macs was radical. iTunes, you know, all these radical innovations.
Yeah.
What do you think is the future of Apple? Do you just think they're just such on a wave that they've got momentum, or do you think they need to innovate?
I 100% agree with you that they brought out, you know, under Steve Jobs, all the absolute brilliant things were brought out under him. Not one item has been brought out since. They're living off their laurels, but boy, did he leave them a legacy.
Yeah.
So that's gonna take a while, because the iPhone, I still think, is the greatest product in the world, and it's gonna take them a long time
to mess it up.
To not be the, you know, to be overtaken, but they will be overtaken because they haven't got Steve Jobs. There's only one Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
The watch, you know.
To me,
you haven't got it.
No.
I haven't got it.
No, well, I don't want to say this too much in the extreme, but I almost feel like I'm being taken the mickey out of.
Yeah.
You know, because I've got the phone, the iPad does exactly the same thing, and the watch does exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like you're making me feel a bit stupid because you're just trying to get me
to
have the same thing, but spend 500 quid here, 1200 quid here, 500 quid here. And I'm told the watch does nothing more.
No.
And I can see people who love Apple are trying to justify it because they love Apple.
Yeah.
But in the end, when do you stop supporting?
I also think watches are unattractive as watches go. I mean, I like watches. You've got a great watch. What make is that?
It's a Richard Mille.
Yeah, well, there you are. You know, and I don't think there's anything attractive about the watch. But as you say, it doesn't actually add to everything. Whereas under Steve Jobs, you know, he brought in iTunes. That was
radical.
He brought, obviously, the iPhone.
The finger technology, you know.
He was like, the first one.
Because everyone was doing this. Do you remember Microsoft were doing all these sort of, you had to have this.
Pen.
Yeah, and then you dropped
it. And the BlackBerry was a very difficult keyboard, you know, very, very small. And but there has been actually not a single thing. I mean, I know that the face recognition, they talk about that, but that's all very, that's not a game changer.
No.
So, I agree with you. But the problem is, so I actually had this discussion with a friend of mine a couple of years ago after Steve Jobs died. I said that, you know, Apple going nowhere, the watch is going to be a flop. Nobody knows what
They won't give
you the figures. So I said, I'm going to sell the shares. Which I did. Yeah. And of course, I made a big mistake. Because what it is with these things is getting the timing right.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced there will come a day, and I can't see any more, you know, they're just living off their laurels. So I can't see that they're going to get that sort of growth. It's still going to be a great company. What I didn't realise is that it's like turning the QE2 round. Mm. These things don't happen overnight. It takes a long time.
Yeah, you're right. And, the legacy of Steve Jobs is such that they could just keep bringing out the same product and not innovate at all. And, I mean, I don't know how long he died ago, but it must be 7 years, 8 years, I don't know.
Not quite that long, but.
A long while ago, anyway. Yeah, and yet they're still one of the most capitalised businesses in the whole world.
It's going to be the only $1 trillion company.
Yeah.
Think about a trillion.
I do hope they innovate because, you know, like I'm a real supporter of businesses that are doing good work.
Yes.
And I do hope that they innovate. But, you know, a lot of people are saying that, you know, some of the other phones, Samsung phones are better, I think.
A lot of people say the Android system is better than the Samsung. And the Samsung is a fabulous phone. It's not quite as stylish as the iPhone. Mm. I've got a Mac and I've got an iPad and I'm all into, and I've got iTunes and everything, so I feel that I can't suddenly break away.
Well, that's the clever part as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
They've got you handcuffed.
Yeah, they have.
Because I just like people, you know, Android or Samsung, whoever, are like, oh, it's really easy to move all your data over. But if you've got Apple TV, blah, 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 all your music, you're not going anywhere. They're good at this closed source type.
Brilliant, brilliant. And even though I'm an internet, you know, I run an internet, but I'm not confident about the technology.
No,
I'm scared.
Not.
I live in fear. Because I have had, you know, as we all have, you know, like the emails don't come through or something like that. And you're terrified because my whole business depends on it. So I don't want to take any chances anyway with my phone or with my laptop. So I stick with Apple. And yeah, you're right. They're very clever.
What were the sort of years when your business was the most successful? I believe you were doing 1.5 billion turnover, something like that.
Yeah, 1.5, 2 billion turnover actually we touched around the end of the, about 1990.
Wow, I mean, that must be like, with inflation, that must be like 8 billion now.
Exactly, I mean, people forget that that was 25 years ago. We were making £125 million profit. There's not a lot of companies making that today, 20 years later.
Yeah.
So it was huge. And we were defying the recession because in 1991, interest rates shot up to about 15%, and the retailers, like today, were beginning to struggle quite badly. But we were defying that, and we were also the only retailer, which is an unbelievable thing even today, that was actually succeeded in the US.
Mm.
Not by transporting our formula over there, by using local management. But yeah, that all that sort of just adds up to the tragedy that happened at the Institute of Directors. Oh, we've actually done quite well because we've gone for about 15 minutes without mentioning it. And I'm the one who brought it up. But that was the tragedy of it because it was such a good business. And even today, I get when I launch my audiobook, there's a plug for you last week. Thanks to you, Rob.
My pleasure.
I've had loads of staff all get in touch with me, you know, and I still have this, people don't seem to realise, even though it sort of ended in tears in the way it did, that I still have, there's not one member of staff that begrudges anything that I do or is critical of me in any way whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, let's come back to that in a minute because what I'm really interested in your thoughts on is how has business changed since the late 80s to now, do you think?
Well, you've got, in the retail business, you've got a lot more competition. You know, when this is really shows my age, but when I started, it was just the high street. We didn't even have the malls.
Mm.
And I remember my father saying that these malls would never catch on, just like people say that the internet would never catch on. That's what everybody always says at the beginning of a new innovation. It was just the high street, and it was basically Marks and Spencer's, Littlewood's, British Home Stores, Boots. And if you knew you were going to get a shop, and it had to be on that side of the street, in a way, you know, you couldn't even open on the wrong side of the street. But if you managed to get amongst those big boys, you knew you were going to get a flow of traffic coming through and past your shop. And that's basically all there is. You obviously have to have the right product. But unless you've got people walking past your shop. You, in those days, you will not sell anything. Mm. And then, of course, the malls started opening, and that spread it a bit further. And people said, well, you know, the high street will suffer for that, which it didn't. It was more the merrier. Then you got the out of town, which happened in the 80s and 90s. And people said, well, that was again the end of the high street. So it was more and more competition. But then again, people were much richer than they were in the 50s and the 60s, where they were very poor. In fact, young people didn't have any money at all, and they didn't go out. Now you see them at bars and restaurants. That was unheard of, and there weren't any restaurants. So you know, the more shops open to actually meet demand. Then finally, the internet started, which started off about 5% of the total thing, then 10%, then 15%. Still not massive, but the growth of it was going up while everything else was going down. So everyone said, well, this might be now the straw that breaks the camel's back, because you've now got, started with the high street, which had it all to themselves, then the malls, then the out of town, now the internet. Now you've got four areas competing with each other. And for the first time, I'm now seeing the high street's gone. And the malls are not doing so well either, because, you know, people are now spoilt for convenience, and, you know, going to the high street, you might get a ticket parking your car, you have to carry all your stuff back, it's pouring with rain, you know, it's not actually a particularly enjoyable experience, you know, you have to, so the malls made it all a bit luxurious and everything like that. And out of town then created loads of car parking, so it's easy. But actually, the easiest way to shop of all is on your phone, just buying something on Amazon or on the internet.
Yeah.
And actually, I was in Curry's looking at a laptop for my son, actually. And not an Apple, because I'm not going to spend that sort of money on it. But the guy in there, with respect, knew nothing about it. Yet if you go on a website, you can learn everything on the internet. You can compare it to any other laptop. You can see exactly what it does. So you're getting, you know, fantastic service. Also, you've got 30-day money back guarantee without any problems, which is a very big thing. You know, in my day, you never had that opportunity. If you bought something, you bought it, you were stuck with it. It's huge. It's apart from Marks and Spencers who offered it, but it's a fantastic thing. So the internet is actually is beating everything at the moment, you know. And I was, this guy that I mentioned to you who bought my house and making a lot of money, he thinks shops are finished.
Mm,
I mean, it's an outrageous statement, but that's what he thinks.
Yeah. You know, when someone says something's finished, I think it is quite an outrageous statement, because the shop fronts will probably have to adapt and innovate in some way, because they're not just all going to keel over and go, oh, we're over.
They can't.
Hence why they have online as well, or, you know, they create more of an experience.
Yeah.
I mean, like Barclays have just really redone their shop front, and they've made it all jazzy and snazzy and seating and luxury. And you can see with their advertising, you know, that they're trying to embrace change, but also they've got, their app is probably the best banking app there is.
Yes, fabulous. I've got it.
And they're very advanced. Mm. So I know what I think this person means is that they're getting disrupted. Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see how they react. A bit like, you know, at first when the black cabs got disrupted by Uber, they're just all having rallies and, you know, oh, this is wrong, you know, get rid of them, ban Uber.
Yeah.
But the smart ones were going and getting a lease on an E-Class Merc for 220 quid a month, and they were driving around in an Uber.
Yeah. But it is the way you react. It's not what happens in business, because shit will happen.
Well, there's going to be change all the time, isn't there?
Yeah, there's always going to be, as you say, disruptive. If you look at all the most successful companies, they've all done it, whether it's Netflix or Uber or Apple or Airbnb, they've all done it they've thrown away the rule book and done it in a completely different way. You know, Netflix don't have any cinemas, Uber don't have any cars, Airbnb don't have any hotels.
Yeah.
That would be unheard of in my father's day when he thought that the malls wouldn't catch on. So, you know, these things do catch on, And it's no good just moaning about saying ban them, you, like the black cabs do, and that's something totally antiquated. Mm. You have to adjust and you have to deal with it. Cause, mm. But there's never been a period like this for change. Mm.
As in so quick and so often, the acceleration of it.
Yeah, but it's just that everybody spends their lives on their phones mm. nowadays.
Yeah. So I tell you what excites me at the moment is, like, across most markets I'm seeing, there seems mm. to be like this decentralization. So, you know, however long, last couple of decades, there's been a bit of a revolt against the big conglomerates, whether it's the banking system mm. or, you know, the almost monopolized retail industry or pharmaceutical industry or whatever. Mm. But, you know, that guy Dave, who set up a bank, the Bank of Dave, mm-hmm. and, you know, a couple of disruptive guys who set up Airbnb and Uber, and, you know, crowd funders mm. who pool individuals' money together. And I really see in business a decentralization, mm-hmm. Which surely is exciting for a startup entrepreneur who can, now a startup entrepreneur can have their own currency. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've just had a Bitcoin speaker talk about cryptocurrencies. You can literally set up your own currency. Mm. You can set up your business from there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you must have had huge overheads with all these retail units that you were either massive cash into or huge loans.
That's the thing. And it's massive amount of overheads having a shop. And it's even worse today. You know, very little of it came through to the bottom line. Mm. You know, you had to carry 5,000 lines in my shops.
There's the next thing, the stock, all the stock you have to carry.
You don't have to carry the stock now. Yeah. All you have to do is you have to carry
Amazon
the stock.
Hold it for you.
Yeah, they don't carry it, yeah. But the thing is that you had to have 5,000 lines in that jewellery shop, even though 80% of your sales came from 20% of your lines. So basically 4,000 of those lines were not worth keeping. But why did you keep those 4,000 lines? Because you didn't look like a jewellery shop. Yeah. You had to have a show. You had to have a selection. On the internet, you only actually sell what sells. Mm. So you haven't got the overheads. The problem now, though, is that Google are the ones that are making all the money because your marketing costs, because of the competition. When I started and I was buying words pay per click, there was hardly any other jewelers out there. So I was buying words, you know, very, very cheaply, pay per clicks, and my marketing costs were sort of 3 or 4%. So I said to myself, well, this is great because, you know, the rents alone were 15% of sales, and here I am to get on page one on Google, only 3 or 4%. But that 3 or 4% now has become an absolutely diabolical 25%, and there's certain lines that I can't even sell. So an eternity ring, which is a very popular internet line, on pay-per-clicks, I'm making £250 on this one particular eternity ring, which is a 1-carat diamond, which I'm selling. But it's costing me £279 every time somebody buys it with Google. So what's happening now? I can't sell that particular line. I have to withdraw one of my best-selling lines.
Right.
So the panacea that everybody thinks from the internet is, from the retailer's point of view, is no longer there. I've had the best years. Mm. It's different if you're Amazon or if you're eBay, because you don't need to promote yourself so much because you're all over the internet anyway. You can't avoid it. And you've got this brand, massive, massive brand. Mm. So they're obviously not spending that. And they get up to all the tricks in the book, you know, which you can't do anymore. I mean, BMW, for instance, they worked out that the more times that somebody clicked on used cars, the higher you got up on page one on Google. So they came up with this brilliant idea of, in very, very small print, putting the word used car 250 times on each page. Mm. So they got 250, and they got onto page one on Google because they got more clicks on used cars than anybody else. Mm. But then they get kicked off Google.
Yeah. Well, isn't this the dance of business, though? You know, like you're getting something early. You got in retail at a good early time. You grew it. Then you got online at a pretty early time compared to most people. Yeah. And then the competition floods in.
Absolutely.
And then the margins reduce.
Absolutely.
And then you either get disrupted or you go and innovate by maybe moving on to Facebook pay-per-click or finding another way to reach
You
customers.
Want to get out of something when everyone on their dog is joining it. Like I remember Bitcoin. Years ago, Yeah, LED watches. These were, for the first time, digital watches came out, and they were like printing money. But then, of course, because it was printing money, everybody came into it. Margins went down. Everything got ruined. So you get out. And, you know, I like to think that I did get into the health business in the late 90s when there wasn't amount of clubs and you could charge quite a lot monthly stuff. I liked that I got into the internet 2001 before a lot of other people did. And even jewellery in the 80s, the demographics were such that it was the young 16 to 24s who had all the money, so which was my customers because it's all around engagements. So those three businesses that I've been in have all been in at the right times. And to be in those businesses at the wrong time, they've all been very, very successful. You know, we're Britain's largest online jeweller. We've had the world's largest jewellery business. The health club business was, you know, I sold, okay, that's the smallest of the lot, but I still sold it for £4 million cash. So all of those businesses would not have worked in the unless it was actually at the right times.
And also, when you say ruined, not from the consumer's point of view, you can get a digital watch for £5.
Yeah.
So it's funny how, like, because I really feel in business now that the consumer has a lot more power. We were just talking about trolls earlier on, and someone can set up a fake profile and go and troll you and lie about you, or they can demand a refund, they can order 10 things online and send them all back.
Yeah.
And it must have been different. Like you said, 25, 30 years ago, if you bought something, that was your commitment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now it's like the power shifted.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you the retailer had complete and utter control. I mean, when Dixon's introduced this MasterCare, and I was talking to Stanley Carms, who built Dixon's business a few weeks ago, and he was making more money out of selling warranty on products than actually the margin on the products.
Wow.
So if you bought a washing machine for £300, just at the till, they would sell you warranty for 3-year warranty, which actually cost £150. Now, if that washing machine didn't go wrong, that was £150 pure profit. And as he only made 30% on the washing machine, which was £100, he was making more on the warranty. In fact, he ended up making nothing selling any of his products other than on the warranty.
And now that would just be expected as part of the...
You wouldn't get it today. Amazon are offering 30-day money-back guarantee and everything like that. The consumer's king.
Yeah.
And margins of, you know... The retailers are being squeezed by both ends because of the competition, as you say, is getting tougher, and then the landlords are squeezing them on the other end in terms of the rent, and then you've got the government. I mean, don't get me on that, but that's just absolutely ridiculous. The rates. I mean, we never had rates of this. Rates on our shops used to be about 20-30%. Now they're 50-60%. What are rates?
Yeah.
It's just an excuse for tax. Why is there business rate? What are you paying that for?
Yeah, and then there's empty property rates. You get penalised for it being empty because you can't fill it.
You never used to pay. If you had empty property when I had my shops in the 1980s, you just claim and said, I'm not paying rates.
And you'd have thought that they'd want to support you to start your business to fuel the economy, not penalise you for struggling.
Well, they did. There was no rates. If you had an empty property, there's no rates on it.
Nowadays, the government.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And the government have done nothing to help the high street. Instead, they called him Mary Portis. You know what? that was moving the deck chairs on the Titanic. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay, so at risk of us going into sort of doom mode.
Yeah.
Does this not though force producers to produce good quality products and services, you know, in a way, is there not an upside of there being the power of the consumer that it forces us to do good work?
Well, I think that...
Might we get a lot more referrals because if we look after people... Because we should be incentivised to look after people.
Because
if we're not, then bad product and service doesn't help the overall consumers, of which you and I are both consumers.
The only other side, I don't want to carry on with this doom and gloom, but the only other side of the coin that I would say... And this has always been the case. I had 1,000 shops in America, and I always saw right through my life, America has always been 10 years ahead of the UK. So you could get some good trends by just going to America. A lot of people have made that money.
Well, podcasting is one of them. They're way ahead of us.
Oh, are they? Right.
Yeah, and, you know, like I wanted to get in quite soon. I waited a bit too long, but, I completely agree. If you want to know how to sell, if you want to know how to do marketing... Come watch the Americans.
Yeah, and my business in America was built on credit which you couldn't actually, in the UK, people were not prepared to get into debt on credit cards, or store cards is huge. We had a store card, which was interest rates were about 42% in the 1980s on the store card.
And people moaned that there was just a 0.25% base rate rise.
Yeah, it bears no resemblance to the base. They were saying the interest rate's now gone up to 0.25%.
I heard someone say it was a hike on Facebook.
But credit cards average is 23% or something.
Yeah.
But people, so we had this very good model where you would actually not only have 43%, you'd have a store card, but somebody would have their limit raised or reduced as they do today. So, but in America, if you phoned, and you did in America, you phoned a customer up and you said that your limit now is being raised from $2,000 to $3,000, they would use that $1,000 immediately. It was quite unbelievable. And but also you would say, but by the way, you'd have all the information, and this is going back to the 80s, on their family. So you would say, well, you know, it's your uncle's birthday next Wednesday and we've got a nice signet ring for him or something like that. And they say, gee, well, we'll have that. And that's the way that they you could sell, because the customer's very receptive. If you did that in the UK in the 80s, people would laugh at you. But now, today, people are prepared to get into debt. They were only prepared to get into debt for cars on the HP and houses. In the early days in this country. Now they're prepared to get into debt for anything.
Clothes,
anything. And the store card, which nobody seems to realise, can be up to, again, 30-35% with all the well-known retailers. If they get offered credit, they'll take it. So although I've been moaning about the retailers being hit, that's been the one big advantage. I'm not making any comment about whether this is good for the... it's obviously not to get into huge debt from the consumer, but that's not my problem. Yeah. My problem is to make a profit. You've got, as a director of a company, and if it's a public company, you've got a I can't even say it, but you've got a duty.
Fiduciary
duty, thank you. So obviously that, I don't take it very seriously if I can't say it. Fiduciary duty to actually make, this is the stupidity of Theresa May saying to bring in unions onto the board. They don't have a fiduciary duty to make profit. We have to shareholders. So anyway, so that is, you know, that has encouraged people to spend a lot of money that they don't have. And that's what we've got at the moment in the UK. People have got an endless pot of money to spend because they've got the ability to borrow. And I don't know how that will end up. In America, they seem to have survived it.
Things tend to sort of go in cycles, don't they? A bit like fashion, where it goes from one extreme back to the other and then back again. So I wonder if at some point people will get sick of the internet. You know, they might want the personal experience again. Because, you know, like you said, we're kind of very connected. I know my attention span's gone down. I mean, I was just recalling, I did a history exam once. It was 2.5 hours. I just remember because I wrote it all in capitals and I didn't finish the exam, and my teacher basically outed me in front of the whole class saying, "Moore, what are you doing writing your whole..." I still got a good mark, I got 81%. He said, "You'd have got 95 if you'd have written it." And that was a two and a half hour exam. I couldn't do a 2.5 hour exam now. I'd have to do 20 minutes instant. On look at my phone, 20 minutes on look at my phone.
It's instant.
Yeah.
Yeah. One thing I do know, and I do this is one of the things that I do mention in my speech, and it's not, there's nothing innovative or clever about saying this, but it's something that I believe in, is that the future will always surprise you. And that is the excitement of being in business, is that, you never can predict the future. And whatever happens, it's always something to amaze you. Because, if Mark Carney can't even predict interest rate increase, which he's been saying for 10 years, along with all the press that interest rates are going up, and they haven't gone up. Okay, they've gone back to what they were a year ago, but they've stayed at 0.5%. But yet, you read in the press all these experts saying that interest rates would go up. Nobody knows. You know, when I tried to raise money in 2003 for my internet business, they all said that the internet was basically a business-to-business vehicle and the public wouldn't. So the experts are always wrong. We're always wrong. That is the excitement about business, is that nobody knows what's around the corner, but it's always something there to surprise you.
Yeah, and for me, that's exciting because, yes, we all want a great business with not a lot of effort that doesn't get disrupted, but the downside to that would be getting up and every day is exactly the same.
Exactly.
Nothing and new, nothing
exciting. I was listening to somebody who was doing a TED talk. He died, actually, unfortunately, this Chinese guy, Tang, who owned these, David Tang, he's written these, he does a column, he used to do a column in the Financial Times, and he said the big excitement about business is the gambling. Mm. Yes, it's not an out-and-out gambling about betting a horse, because if you're buying a property, you're in control, and you're very excited because you think it's a good property, but you don't know for sure what's going to happen, whether you're going to sell it or whether something's going to happen around the corner that's going to affect it or whether that town's going to go down. It's the excitement. That's what really is an adrenaline rush. In business, the whole time, you are gambling. And gambling, that is a very, very exciting because you don't know. You can lose a hell of a lot.
Yeah, and that makes the wins even more exciting.
Yeah, and that's what gives you enormous thrill. It's not, you know, so much about the money. Mm. You know, it's that excitement that you get. Like no other excitement. You don't get that excitement in any other way, or maybe one other way, but that's about it.
And you're obviously not referring to watching Arsenal.
No. funny enough, I was talking to one of the girls out there, and she says, one of the blokes in here, all he ever talks about is football. He's obsessed with football, and all these men are obsessed. She says, you know, it's a bit annoying because, you know, your boyfriend always seems to be more interested in football than interested in me and all that sort of stuff. And when I've always been obsessed with football, and this isn't actually, you're different because you still adore Liverpool, don't you? But the time that I was least interested in Arsenal, and I've travelled them all, followed them all around the world and so on, was when I was very, very successful. For those 7 years between 1984 and 1991, I was so upset.
Because you were getting your kicks yourself.
I was getting my kicks. Yeah, exactly. And for the first time, I couldn't tell you what the Arsenal teams were. Well, I wasn't interested that much. But then when I lost my job, I suddenly got interested in football again.
and you needed them to make you feel better.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that I think business, when it gets to a point when it can be that exciting and stimulates you so much, it tends to take over from everything else. Mm. And it's difficult to be interested in football at that time. It's actually difficult to, it's not healthy because it's actually not often easy to have a relationship or a family, be really good, you know, father and stuff like that. So, you know, well, maybe I'm the exception, but I sort of get obsessions like that.
Yeah, well, I think most of the best business owners in the world seem to have that obsession, don't they? You know, you don't have to, because you don't have to be a billion-dollar company owner. No. But, you know, certainly if you look at Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, whoever.
Yeah.
You know, like, some of them have more balance than others, but definitely obsessive, you know, passionately into it.
Yeah. And, which is not healthy. You should, I mean, looking back, I should have stopped and not gone as, you know, there is a time to stop.
But then if you went back and did it all again, might you just do the same thing again?
Well, I was in my 30s, so like you, Rob, I was a young man, and it's slightly now, after losing everything and making it back, and make no mistake, my businesses today are nothing like the size of my old business, but I now wouldn't want to risk it all again like I did before, no.
And of course, that has an upside in that it's not as, you know, sort of erratic and emotional. But I guess the downside is it maybe slows your growth down a little bit.
Oh, there's no question whatsoever about that, that I have now turned down opportunities and I was much more impulsive. I was bought every jewellery shop business that moved on both sides of the Atlantic. Yeah. You know, I had to be the biggest of that. And it's much more measured now, much more sensible. Mm.
I think a lot of that is life stage as well, isn't it? Because it was very kind of you to say I'm young, but I'm not far off 40 now. I'm 38.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely different to what I was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I value my time.
Yeah.
I need it. I feel like I want a bit more rest. Obviously, I've got kids. I want to spend time with them.
I'm Bobby's a great golfer.
Yeah, exactly. I've got that. I want a balance. I'm more patient.
Yeah.
And patience is a great thing, but sometimes in business, patience isn't a good thing.
I didn't have any patience.
And that's why you grew so fast.
Oh, God, I couldn't wait for a lift. It was ridiculous. Just totally ridiculous when I look back at that. And the traffic jam, I drove down the lay-by on the M1, you know, for 50 miles. Nothing could stop me, and it's not healthy. But you are at your peak, and you know, people used to say to me when I was in my late 30s, as you are, you know, and I was buying their companies, and it was men in their 50s and 60s. Well, you're, you know, you're at the right age now to take it over. You're at your peak, and you soon realise, just like a footballer, that you're not the person that you were, and that's just a fact. I don't want to sound negative because I love business. You know, I still love business, and it's still very, very exciting. But I don't have this sort of pace. You lose, just like football, you do lose pace, and you're not rushing around like you used to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at what Bill Gates is doing, he's spending as much of his time in philanthropic ventures now as he is commercial ventures, which is great.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've turned down a lot of opportunities across the world. 10 years ago, I would have been on a plane all around the world trying to set up Progressive here, Progressive there, in all these different locations. And then when my kids were born, I thought, I'm not going away because I'd regret a lot more them growing up and not knowing who their dad was than missing, you know, an opportunity to have a business in another continent. And I'm fully aware that that slowed my growth.
Yeah.
But I think it's good to want to grow, but when you become consumed and obsessed by growth.
The perfect life, and it isn't only about making money, as you say, because you don't want to end up this multi-billionaire in, or you might do, in some office with screens all around you, very lonely, you know, without any family or anything like that, on your fifth divorce, hardly ever seeing your kids. You know, you have to have some. When you're younger, that's all you think about is being successful.
Yeah.
But there is a balance, and you are happier. I know I don't look happy, that's my face, but I feel like I am generally a happier person than I was, even when I was, you know, had a £2 billion turnover.
Sure. People ask me a lot, and I'd love to ask you, you know, how much money is enough? Because I'm still at the stage where no money is enough, because I still feel like, and you know, you're more experienced than me. So, you know, you've been turning over billions and then you've done millions, and you know, is 5 million, 10 million, 20 million, 50 million, 100 million, what's enough?
Well, the point is that we don't really need the iPhone X, which we're both getting. we could probably be quite happy with the iPhone 5 and it would just do as
well. Actually, that's the best size, the iPhone 5, I think.
Yeah, well, the iPhone X is actually smaller than the plus one. Yeah. But yeah, we don't need... I mean, you saw Madonna, now she lives in Lisbon, getting on EasyJet and stuff, which I admire. I think there's nothing better when I see somebody who's made it and got lots of money who's not actually throwing it around, like the Kardashians have to do it. I mean, there's something really sort of unsavoury about that. And so, you know, you don't... The trick is to actually live a really modest and frugal life. You don't need... I know you've got a Ferrari and all that sort of stuff and loads of car stuff like that, which is great, and I had all of those cars and stuff like that.
Most of those don't stress the overhead, though. You know, most of them either bought outright in cash. The Ferrari's gone up 30 grand.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, whilst it can look like you can be really lavish, if you can hopefully think smart about it, then.
Yeah, I think those sort of things are great, but I think there's a lot of the sort of everyday stuff that we just waste our money on, which you don't really need to. Do we need another restaurant or sort of thing, or do you have to go first class? Do you have to stay in this great hotel? So when you ask, you know, what money is enough, I don't think that all spending as much as possibly can on everything that you do, it has to be the most expensive of clothing and the most expensive of everything, actually is necessary.
No.
It used to be for me, which is pathetic.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, it really isn't. And you don't have to have, you know, it's all hype. Mm. When they launch some new product, they say you've got to have it. Or even if it's the latest film that you have to see or the latest restaurant that you have. We're all like sheep. We say, oh, well, we have to do this, we all have to do that. But actually a lot of very successful people, and the reason they're rich is not that they save a few quid by not going to their restaurant. It's their whole mindset, I think, that they are careful and they respect money. Yes, they do live in huge expensive houses and stuff like that, which of course are going up in value, but they don't actually stupidly waste money, while a lot of people that are sort of don't have anything like as much money do spend on things that are just a waste of money. So.
Yeah, it's funny. As I've got towards my 40s, like I love going to Selfridges and Harrods. I do like buying nice clothes. Yeah. But 4 times in every 5, I won't buy anything. Yeah. And 10 years ago, when I didn't have as much money, I'd have to come away with £3,000 worth of clothes.
Yeah.
And now I know I'm not going to end up wearing that. And then every time when you do buy something nice, you can afford something a bit nicer and it's more special.
Yeah.
And, you know, whilst I do sometimes travel first class, sometimes if it's a short haul flight, premium economy is absolutely fine.
Yeah, I do premium economy.
Or you do business a year in advance with your American Express points.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you buy a Ferrari, which isn't going to go down in value or something like that.
Yeah, but it's that is, you know, infinitely sensible, but they are, unfortunately, it's a lot of people that with the least amount of money that are buying things they can't afford.
Because they're stuck in consumerism and they don't know about assets and liabilities.
There was an example of a woman who lived in a Glasgow council flat who saw posh Spice with a pair of Chanel sunglasses for £230 and she had to have them because it was on the front of Hello magazine.
Yeah.
She bought these glasses for £230 and her children were not being fed.
Mm.
You know, that is, that's all right, extreme.
Yeah.
But you learn lessons from that.
Yeah.
You know, and I've learnt from the day when I had, you know, I had a £850,000 salary, I'd had a huge shareholding, money really didn't matter. And by the way, you know, tax wasn't even that high. And I was spending money, you know, but I lost it all. And that did teach me a lesson to respect it. And if, you know, to not throw it all around in that way.
Yeah, well, it's funny because Mark and I jointly owned an Ariel Atom, which was one of those ridiculous fast cars, and actually we sold that for £2,000 more than we bought it. Mark taught me how to do all this stuff. You know, like, you really can enjoy nice material items just as a way of storing money.
Yeah.
And immediately when we sold it, Mark said to me, "Oh, I've got to find another asset to put that in." And that thought process, I thought, he's taught me that over the last 10 years because, you know, I must admit, when I got, you know, whatever it was, £20,000, my half, in the bank, I thought, where can I go and throw that? Well, and Mark's immediately thinking, I need to find an asset to put that in.
Well, that's not spending money. That's investing money.
But if the asset is a Rolex Daytona that you get to wear.
Yeah,
You know, or it's Mark wants to get a 1950s Mercedes.
Yeah.
Which you'll be able to enjoy a bit.
Absolutely.
I was watching Metallica's documentary and Lars Ulrich.
You went to see them, weren't you?
Yes. Yeah. They're fantastic.
Yeah.
And about them and their challenge and their journey, I love as much as their music. Because I always like the stories of people, which I think was why I've been attracted to you and what you do. And Lars Ulrich was going around buying a load of art. And then when he flogged it, he made a load of money on it.
Yeah. You get more pleasure from art than anything else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the way to do it, is to just not to spend it or to invest it. Rather than
or if you have this emotion to go and throw money away, park it into something where the value won't go down.
And you get more pleasure from that
than
anything else.
Mm. So there's another industry, Gerald, that you're, because you know, you're a pioneer. You get in early, but not too early. And, you know, of course, you got into retail early, but not too early. You got into internet early, not too early. Another big industry, if you like, which is almost now as much of a commodity as maybe what oil or something like that is the selling of information. You know, books, audio books, podcasts, courses, online courses, and of course you make a great living as a keynote speaker, which is the same thing. So is that something you ever saw yourself doing, or just
well, again, when I said that you could never predict the future, that especially as I made the worst corporate gaffe in history, and it's gone down as the worst speech of all time. It is ironic that I've made so much money.
Feasting off it.
Yeah, making speech. I'm almost getting the money back that I lost. But no, and the difference is now that companies are spending on people like me to have them at events. You know, I'm doing things for Barclay, as I said, with you, and Boots and companies like that. People are using outside so-called experts or that sort of stuff much more. So that's turned into a very lucrative business, which is your business, apart from your property business, which I don't think anybody's been more successful than you doing that. And again, that didn't exist when I was started off in business in the 70s or 80s. We didn't have, you know, I go to... You know, and I love doing speeches for another reason. As I travel around, and meet people in all these different companies. I'm often sitting there sort of an hour or two. I always get there an hour or two early. I say it's because of the traffic. It's not actually. It's because I want to sit there and listen to, often it's an internal company. I mean, I went to one a few weeks ago where they supplied eggs to the supermarket. And I learned a hell of a lot of things. I know you might think, well, what's the use of learning anything about eggs?
Well, it's business. If you're interested in business,
And it's a huge asset for me to know that. It helps me, actually, knowing about the way that they market eggs, actually. You know, there's one or two things that I pick up in terms of selling jewellery and stuff like that.
And also, it will make your speech more relevant because you know about your audience.
Yes, I do. Yeah, I mean, I once did read a book where it says the most important thing in a speech is to know your audience. Mm. And there are certain people that are absolutely brilliant that actually talk.
Call back to earlier things said.
Yeah, quite amazing. I wouldn't say that I've got that sort of ability, but I just love doing the speeches. Mm. You know, it's like being in show business in a way that, you know, your adrenaline. I was listening to John Cleese saying that when he did this one-man stage play, that he was doing things on that stage that he thought he was incapable of doing. He certainly couldn't do it in one-to-one conversation. But because he was on the stage, you have to perform. You're forced to it, and you get this adrenaline rush. And when you get an adrenaline rush, your brain's working much faster, you're much quicker, because you're under pressure. And you think, oh, I hate this, you know, I'm not really looking forward to it. But when you're up there, you perform much better. So, yeah, it is great to be able to perform much better than you normally do in the office or something like that. Mm. And you can only do that on a stage, because you can only do that when you get an adrenaline rush. Mm. So that you get a tremendous amount of excitement out of. But yes, what you have to do, even though I'm some sort of dinosaur, you have to embrace, whether it's audio books, which I'm doing this week, or whether it's, you know, podcasts or speeches, you have to embrace what is, it's not rocket science. That if people now are suddenly using their phones the whole time and they'd rather do Audible from Amazon than buy books and sit at home or go to the library, which in my day they used to go to the library to get their books, you know, and used to get fined if it was late. So, you know, there's no point in living in that world. No. You know, you've got to adapt. And I've adapted to it in a lot of ways. I'm not innovative. None of these are my ideas. Yeah. But on the other hand, I'm no slouch in not adapting. Mm. And some people weren't. I mean, I remember once in America, they brought out in the 1950s cubic zirconia, which was a copy of diamonds.
Right.
And the guy, Marvin Zale, who owned Zales, the biggest jewelers in America at the time, said he's going to get out of the jewelry business because if they've managed to manufacture diamonds, then there's no future in diamonds whatsoever. So you've got to be very careful in sort of being a pioneer and making statements like that and doing things. I'm more somebody that just follows what is in fashion and try and exploit it to the full.
Well, I think a lot of people sort of perceive that innovation, you have to create it and design it. Well, Steve Jobs didn't create most of the tech that he leveraged.
You're absolutely right.
The touch screen and all those things that he's used.
The tablet was out before. Yeah. Which is one of the most successful products. He didn't produce he wasn't the first person to produce the tablet.
Yeah, and Xerox and other companies were, he sort of, you know, licensed or leveraged the.
Yes. What
technology.
Did he learn? He was shown round Xerox.
Yeah, and I think that
they never used it.
That may have been the mouse or the touch screen.
The mouse.
Screen.
It was the mouse.
Yeah.
So Steve Jobs was the first person to launch the mouse, which obviously is nothing today, but in its day it had a pretty good run.
Yeah, and what he's saw it do, he can see a better use for it.
Yeah, exactly.
And that can be innovation. So I think a lot of people, they don't think they're creative or they don't think they can. Yeah. But you don't have to.
You don't have to be. I started this whole thing with the success that we did have with Ratners was basically to no longer have the chandeliers and the velvet pads and very expensive, which the jewellers felt they had to have because it was a status symbol. It was a once in a lifetime, very special. Like in the old days, going to a very expensive restaurant. That's all changed with McDonald's and stuff like that. Mm. So what I did was I got rid of that threshold barrier and let young people feel very comfortable coming into the shops by pricing everything, discounting everything, playing pop music, which people thought was ridiculous in a jeweler shop. I did everything which was a nemesis of a jeweler. Mm. Got rid of the chandeliers. Nobody had to wear a three-piece suit. That was the hugely most successful thing, which enabled us to be the fastest growing business 2 years running in the 80s in the whole stock market, and enabled us to buy H. Samuel and Ernest Jones and all the rest. Basically, that was none of my doing. I copied it from a guy called Robert Anthony, who was based up in Newcastle and Sunderland, because somebody said, hey, there's a jeweller up north that has got queues at his doors at 8 o'clock. And I went up there and he was the first person doing that. Mm. But he didn't really...
And he was testing the model for you, because the great thing about not being the first is someone's testing it for all the quirks and the risks of it going on.
And rather than me be the first person to get rid of diamond rings from the front window and put in chains and earrings for 99p and all that sort of stuff, somebody else had already done all the spade work for me and was successful.
Mm. So two more things, because I know you've got to go and do your speech.
Yes.
We don't want you to be late for that.
No. It's not a speech, it's an interview, I believe, isn't it?
Oh, yes, of course, sorry.
Yes, they've heard my speech.
Semantics. Yes. Yeah, your speech. Yeah. So the downside, I guess, or one of this information age, where there are people who, when you ask them what you do for a living, they say, I'm a YouTuber. You ask someone else what you do for a living, I'm a podcaster. You know, these are unheard of things, which are great upsides. And one of the downsides is maybe the speed at which critics, trolls and haters can get all over you.
Yeah.
How do you see that's changed since it was really mainstream media that kind of did it to you?
Yeah. I mean, when I made the speech in Albert Hall in 1991, I'd already planned to get all the stock market analysts out to my American shops to show them round, to show them what we were doing in America, as you did. And they were all going to the airport, and one of them arrived in, I was already in America to meet them in Akron, Ohio, which is in the middle of, you wouldn't want to, just awful place, completely cut off, but that's the right place to have a head office. Anyway, so they all came out and they were all talking. One of the analysts, she said, well, she got a taxi to the airport, and the taxi driver was doing nothing but talking about Joel Ratner, about his crap speech and all this stuff like that. He was full of it. Mm. And there was no internet and there was no Twitter or anything like that, but it was the front page of the Sun and the Mirror, and bad news travels fast as well, and people would talk. Today, and 26 years later, I don't know why I'm a masochist like this, but I would go search me on Twitter. Sometimes because I often hear that somebody's booked me for a speech which I didn't even know about, so I know I'm now going to get a contract for that, and that sometimes goes on to. So I check what's, or sometimes people talk about what I've done on my speech, but most of the time it's people comparing me with some idiot who has just screwed up, which is a little bit upsetting, as I built the world's largest jewellery business, built UK, then lost everything and then carried on. And there's not a lot of people then, you know, there's not a lot of people who build a business that size, A, full stop, and then B, lose it all and then build again. Yeah. But yeah, but nevertheless, I'm the poster boy for failure.
Right.
So when every time screw up, they compare it to this, you know, to me. And you get nasty things. I mean, I made a joke. It was a bad joke. I hold my hands up. Don't blame the press. It was a stupid, stupid mistake. But, you know, when they say that I despised my customers, I have contempt, treat them in that way, which is so the opposite of what I am. And my staff would all testify to that, how I valued my customers. It was just a stupid joke about Sherry DeCanter. But, and, of course, they say it that about my jewellery, and they say that. And when the complete... And these people are critics, basically. And business isn't about the critics, it's about the people that are actually prepared to get their hands dirty, and they will fail and they'll succeed, and that's all part of it. And but at least that, you know, you and I have done that, we've put our head above the parapet and we've been in business and we've had our setbacks and we've had our successes. But these people are so timid that they wouldn't even step into the ring. All they want to do is to be on Twitter and to criticise.
In a fake profile with no photo on, just hiding behind
They're anonymous as well.
I always say to some of my speakers or people that I mentor, I say, you know, when you get your first little online attack or whatever, you should go and have a little drink and celebrate, because anyone who is anyone in business of any size and any scale is going to get it. It's like you know, I'd love to say you get better, you get less. But that would just be a complete lie.
It's the opposite.
It is. And I was watching, been really studying deeply Metallica's journey, not just for their music, but, you know, when Lars Ulrich sued Napster. Yeah. I mean, you know, bands don't get paid to do their art. You know, someone who's got a job has a job and they get paid. Whereas a band has to go into pubs all around the country, getting paid nothing, travel and accommodation they have to sort out. And they have to do that for years. And they make good art and then they commercialise it. If they're lucky, and most of them don't, they take all these huge risks. And then companies go and nick their art and give it away for free. And that guy, Lars, stood up and said, that's wrong. And at one point he did an interview and he basically said, I've become the most hated man in rock and roll because I just tried to stand up for, you know, not stealing our art. And I just think...
I think you're right about the fact that the more successful you become, the more flack you get. And, you know, one would argue, not that I would argue the most person successful person, but a lot of people would argue, if you become prime minister, you've become about as successful as you can get, or president or whatever. Yet they would get more criticism than anybody, even whether the successful ones or the less successful. They would just, they
it's
would be the most hated.
Chalice, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, like Obama, for example, such a great speech.
Yeah, and a wonderful man.
Yeah, but so good at speeches, everyone's saying, oh, well, maybe he's only good at speeches and no good at policy. Yeah. I mean, he's good at speeches and he's getting criticised for it. It's like, so, you know, like, I really always like to direct people to you, your book, because I just think there are some people that are a little bit wimpy and weak. And, you know, someone says boo to them and they like make a big drama out of it. Or they don't put their art out into the world, whether, you know, business or creative, because they're worried about that. You must have become thicker skinned and you must have learned a lot through what you've gone through.
Well, I love my business. And as I explained to you, I was obsessed with it and it was everything to me, which is not healthy, but nevertheless, that's what it was. And I was very proud of the fact that I built a business from basically nothing. It was a small loss-making business to the world's largest business with 2,500. And it was a great achievement. It was done with a lot of young people around me. And we'd been through very hard times to get there. And I was very, very proud of what I'd achieved. And to then suddenly be dragged through the gutter and everybody make fun of that business, forget the fact I lost every single penny I had and I had tax bills to pay on money on share options that were now worthless, and I was lying in bed watching Countdown because I was so miserable. Forget all that, you know. It was just the most awful time. It wasn't so much the fact that I'd lost all this money. It was just the fact that, you know, I'd lost everything that I'd built. You know, and people say, well, nobody died, but you know. It was as bad as it can get without anyone dying, you know, to build all that and to lose it over such a stupid thing. It was a horrendous thing. And it was a very, very difficult thing to go through, and it took a long time to go through. And yet, at the when I came out the other end, because you've gone through such an awful experience, you do value things that perhaps other people wouldn't value, just like somebody who's perhaps ill, you know, would value just being alive or something like that. And I'm not comparing myself to that. So I do agree with you where today in business that people are so dramatic about a setback and making such a song and dance and, you know, such a fuss and thinking, oh, doom and gloom, it's the end of the world and stuff like that. You know, really, it is nothing. You know, that is life. And I've always quoted a book that I read by Scott E. Peck called The Road Less Traveled, when his first line of the book is, life is difficult. If you accept that, it's no longer difficult. People don't realise that business is difficult and life is difficult, and it is the norm to have massive setbacks, and you don't burst into tears or give up on that first setback. You know, that is something that you've just got to toughen up about.
I do see a lot of people who, I think if someone is offended very easily, that says as much about them as what has been said. I put a post on Facebook just saying that, you know, when people draw their eyebrows with what looks like a rather large felt tip pen, maybe some of us men aren't into that and we like the natural look. And man, you should have seen some dramatic reactions to that. It's my Facebook page, you know, surely free speech.
Exactly.
And I just think, you know, like, yes, it's not very nice being trolled. especially when it's lies, especially when it's a fake profile, especially when people have got their ulterior motives to sell their own media or newspapers or get you on their websites.
Exactly.
That's the cost and responsibility of success.
Yeah, yeah.
And final thing then, because I remember in 2006 when I read your book, The Rise and Fall and Rise Again, and I was so inspired by it. And I was just so inspired by the way you got back up and you know, and sorted it out, and also the way you built businesses in different niches. I mean, really, you've done retail, two different retails with Jim, and then online, and now the speaking.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the book, which is a... And I remember someone who was trying to get a mortgage and he got it pulled, and it was someone I was mentoring, and he was so beside himself and angry, and he was sort of blaming us a bit.
Yeah.
And I gave him your book. I just gave it to him as a gift. And he used to come up down from Newcastle to Peterborough and back up once a month for our sessions. And I said, read that. And he read the whole book by the time we got to Newcastle. He phoned me up and he said, oh man, what a great book. I realised I was being completely melodramatic.
Yeah, yeah.
I get why you gave me the book. And it really changed him. And I think that your book has that great effect on people to contextualise their own small problems.
Yeah.
And that's why I was really excited to partner with you on getting your book on Audible.
And thanks for partnering me on it. And I do think that with a business autobiography, that it really comes to life when the person who actually wrote it reads it. And I'm very, very excited about it. And thanks for giving me the opportunity of launching it on Audible.
My pleasure.
A plug for you.
Yeah, please. It's live now. It literally just went live in the last couple of days, didn't it?
Because
I saw
did.
You update your it Facebook. Did.
And I told my daughter, who's running, she never read the book when it came out, but this tells you everything.
There you go.
And she's now jogging, listening to it on the phone.
Well, I now sell about two times more books, a ratio of about 2-1, on Audible versus Amazon. So, yeah. I mean, you must have sold a lot of the paperback version, so hopefully we can double those sales.
I didn't get to your level because you got to number one, and also I see in the States or abroad or somewhere like that.
It's done good, but you
money.
Know. Yes, yeah. Yeah. But, you know,
good
like.
Good title.
Yes, yeah, it is. Yeah. So I got a 1-star review and someone said, not what I expected. It's called money and it wasn't what you expected. There you go. So, look, if you're listening or watching, Gerald's book, brand new on Audible. It's never been on audio before, has
no.
it? So it's the first opportunity you've got to listen. The Rise and Fall and Rise Again. That's the title. Go and get it right now. It was one of the defining books in my career that just made me toughen up a bit and made me be more grateful.
Right.
And also just to really get to know Gerald's side. Because obviously the media side, it's just like, I still have some people that, you know we're friends and, Gerald, he said and did this. And I'm actually like, no, he didn't say that. And no, he didn't do that. That's how it was twisted.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I was courting media for quite a long time and I turned down quite a lot of, in my niche, probably not at your level, but in my niche, quite big media opportunities.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to be misportrayed.
That is the thing that upsets me the most, that people don't. That they've got this perception, I'm defined by this one thing and it's not me. And it is a monkey on your back that you have to live with all your life. But, you know, as we said before, I'm not complaining and accept.
And you're getting many, many keynote speeches.
Which I probably wouldn't have
got. That's so smart, though. Just think about that. A massive difficulty in your life. How long ago was that? In the 90s?
When I said the speech, it was 91, April 91, it was a long time ago.
And how many speeches have you done since, paid speeches?
I have done...
Like hundreds?
No, it's more like thousands.
So you're leveraging it and you've been leveraging
it. I am, and I wouldn't have done it if I... So there's always a silver lining. If I've got a silver lining for that, there must be a silver lining for anything, because it was the biggest gaffe in corporate history. Mm. But what people do like to hear in a speech or in anything is they like to hear about calamities and disasters, as long as it's got a happy ending, and mine's got a reasonably happy ending. They rather see it's dark and shade, you know, black and white, rather than somebody who just gets up and blowing their own trumpet and has just gone from one success to the next.
That's just not real life. Yeah, who has done that?
Well, there was ones I did hear with John Corwell recently who had done that.
Right.
And he sold his business for £1.5 billion.
But if you dug deep, though, he had some challenges.
Well, not in this speech, because he had he showed a slide of his huge house, in albeit it was in Stoke, and with all his cars outside and his glamorous wife, and it just was, as you see, you're like me, a bit suspicious, which you should be in business. You should always delve, because there's always something under the carpet. But this speech was just like that, you know, everything had just gone. In a way, being in the phone business at that time, mobile phone business, and selling it for that amount, it was, you know, pretty impressive. Mm. But the speech was, Johnny's a really nice guy, but it was the worst speech I've ever heard. Even though he was so successful, because it was, because it is, you say, it's not real life.
That's probably why.
All the people in the audience liked can come up to me afterwards and say, "Well, I can identify with this. I didn't make, they didn't make a mistake as big as mine, but they certainly made a lot of mistakes." And you know, one guy came up and he says, "My bank foreclosed on me today, and you've cheered me up because your situation is far worse than mine."
Well, there you go, and you know, that's actually a great gift we can give to people, just to make them, to lift them up a bit, because sometimes we think the problems and difficulties we're having, we can get so inside ourselves and make them bigger than they are. And sometimes we look at everyone else, like you said with about John.
Yeah.
You can look at other people going, "Oh, they're doing so well. Why is it hard for me?"
Yeah.
You know, I often look at, you know, because my podcast's doing really well in the UK. So a lot of people in the UK must be looking at my podcast thinking it's doing well. But I'm comparing myself to Joe Rogan and Tim Ferriss and the American ones, who've been doing it for many years longer than me. And aren't necessarily any more successful in their businesses than me, but always comparing myself to their downloads.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And creating our own problems through comparing ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's why I think people love your story.
Yeah, that is the trouble. There's always somebody always doing better than you, then you have to
realise
that.
But if you look with balance, there'll be areas of their life where they're not doing better than you.
That's absolutely right. Mm. And that's the side you don't see. And you don't see it on social media, because all you see on social media...
Filters! Yeah, those people who are really happy on social media, probably crying with depression in the background.
Life isn't the way it is portrayed on social media or on television, where you see an advert for Fairy Snow and it's husband and wife and the daughters are running and it's sunny. And life isn't like that.
My house doesn't look like that.
Well, somebody said a very good quote today, that we're not a Volvo driving dinner on the table family. Mm.
Yeah, so who is? Yeah.
No, exactly.
Yeah. Right, so quickly before you go then. So Gerald's book is now on Audible, which is very exciting. You've got to go and get it. It's called The Rise and Fall and Rise Again. But we've got a special offer for you, because Gerald, you've kindly agreed to do a speech, keynote speech.
Yes.
February time, I believe.
Right.
Yeah.
Have I?
Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
Well, yeah. I think I know about that.
I think we've got that booked. So if you get Gerald's book on Audible, and you just send me the receipt, either PM on Facebook or in one of the communities you're in, or if you message me on rob.moore@progressiveproperty.co.uk, I can get you a free ticket on that. But I think we're only having it upstairs in our training suite, which can hold max a couple of hundred people. So it's very intimate, considering we have 1.15 million subscriptions to the podcast around the world. So basically, the first 200 who get the copy on Audible can come and have an afternoon and an evening with Gerald. And we've also got a couple of other great keynote speakers. And the theme is going to be business and business cash flow. So if that's not an incentive to go and get Gerald's book, which you shouldn't really need, I don't know what is. So go on to Audible, get it, and then make sure you just prove to me you've got it somewhere. And maybe you'll be able to meet Gerald in the future. Gerald, thank you very much.
Rob, thanks once again.
Thank you.
I'll see if Arsenal have lost now.